everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Howdy.
Adam Vitale.
Welcome back, Brian.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And Chaman Wu.
How's it going?
So yeah, I'm back. So I've been pretty off grid for just non-work related reasons. Basically, I was 2 weeks ago. I was helping install a floor at a family friend's house. Just like one of those vinyl tile things, they just kind of snap together, but it's still very tricky. And then last week, it was a little bit of an extended weekend, not quite a vacation, but a short weekend trip. So thank you to Josh and everyone for holding down the fort for the last 2 weeks. I know you had some extended cast at least 2 weeks ago for talking about Monster Hunter. I believe you had a few extra people on. Mm-hmm. And then last week you focused on the Suikoden remasters, which I did play Suikoden 1 over my trip as like my plane, you know, late night and the Airbnb sort of game. So it was fun to play through, and I've also been playing through Monster Hunter. So it was kind of cool to listen to you guys as a, you know, just a listener to the podcast.
Home away from home, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so it was just a personal trip to see some spring training in Arizona. So it was fun, first time doing that. Pretty off-grid, though, for the last few weeks. So I was here 3 weeks ago when we talked about, what was it? It was Avowed, and then it was Pirate Yakuza, I believe, was the last one I was on. So I've not really been, you know, keeping up to snuff on stuff. So this podcast will be a little bit of, for me, kind of getting my feet back.
Oh, in your mind, the most recent releases were Avowed and Pirate Yakuza. Mad Snarker Violence hasn't come out for you yet.
It's one of those things where I've played Monster Hunter, and this sounds kind of silly because like all of these games really in the grand scheme of things just came out, but when we talk about games on a weekly basis, some of them feel further away than they actually are. I've played through Monster Hunter, but you know, I'm only quote unquote past low rank. Like I just saw the credits, which I know is not really the, you know, it's just low rank.
That's but it. Like, you're so never gonna catch up to everyone, dude. You're so low. Yeah,
I already see people at Hunter rank like 100 plus, and I'm sitting here at Hunter rank 11. I'm so behind. I'll never catch up. I'll never enjoy. Whatever. But yeah, so maybe I'll talk about those things in passing as we go through the podcast today, as we do. But as we've been covering basically a new pretty big release every week, since last October, I don't know, since forever. This week, we're going to be talking about the newest series entry in the Atelier series, which is Atelier Yumiya, which we've talked about through several contexts about its potential shift to an action RPG, what it can take from the Ryza series all throughout the previews and the preview opportunities we've had for that game. But we've had a few people on the podcast have a chance to play through Atelier Yumiya and talk to it ahead of its official release next week. So both Chow and James have been able to play through Yumiya, and I don't know who wants to take point on discussing this as our primary game this week. I guess I'll go to Chow first, because Chow wrote the review for us. So we have the review up on the site, rpgsite.net, but if you have or haven't read the review, we'll give Chow a chance here to speak to Yumiya. I don't know what else you've played on the Atelier series, or if it's been a while, and then we'll let James and Chow kind of bounce off each other as they discuss their time with the game. So Chow, take it away.
Okay, so I have played several Atelier games before, but I didn't really like fully complete one until the Arlen Saga started. I started with the Iris series first.
I mean, can I just butt in real quick? I feel like that you already have a leg up on most Atelier fans if you're saying, oh, I didn't play until the Arlen Saga, when I feel like many modern fans started well past that, so... You're a veteran.
Oh. Just based off sales alone, statistically, most people in the West definitely started with Ryza.
or Dust Trilogy at best. So
Chow's established himself as an Atelier ancient gamer right now.
Okay, now, am I ancient now?
Okay, so let me just see if I can get this clear. It's Arland, then is Dusk after that, or am I skipping one?
Like the trilogies? Yeah, it's Arland, then Dusk, then Mysterious, then Ryza, which I think is a secret, and now it's Yumiya.
And just to get the whole shaggots, in my review, it's like Arland has this time limit, so you have like a certain time to like get everything done, right? And they didn't really get rid of the time limit until the last game in the Dusk series, which is Shantae or whatever it was.
Shally.
Shelly. Okay, yeah, it was on that game, but they got rid of the time limit. It's not exactly on Ryza, but the way I say my review is Ryza, but if you want to be, like, so specific, you will say, you know, it's that game, right? But, yeah, so anyways, that's my experience with it. I played several of them. I was even talking to my friends, like, oh, yeah. It's like, do you remember the Atelier game on a DS? It's like, oh, yeah, Atelier Annie. It's like, but I'm sure nobody remember that game at this point, right? So, but anyways, that's my experience with it. What about yours, James?
I got started with the Dusk Trilogy. I played Aisha on the Vita. And then I think what happened is that at the time, the person that we were going to have to review Ryza 2 ended up being busy, or I don't remember the exact circumstances, but I ended up getting assigned that. So I went back and played Ryza 1, and then I just ended up... that's how I ended up playing the Ryza Trilogy. Yeah, yeah.
I forgot that you had to go back to go for Ryza 1.
So. Well, no, I know. I played Ryza 1 before I did the Ryza 2 review. It was like it was a situation where I was like, well, I'll just play this really quick.
He caught up before the research. The assignment. Yeah.
Caught up for research. No. He's like, he got the assignment and he did it.
Okay, so but... now fast forward is here. Now we're at Yumiya. Now there's the next big mainline entry after the Ryza trilogy has passed us. I know there's been Resident Rihanna, the mobile game that came out in Japan and global, soon to EOS end of service and global, and then there's gonna be a spin-off or some new console title in the Resident Rihanna universe coming after this sometime, but. Right now, that's kind of like their next mainline saga, I guess, after Ryza, starting with this game, right?
Yeah. Oh, I do think that if they do make another game, it's like, I don't know how it would take from there. It's like most games, it's like there's lots of, you know, like kind of loose ends and stuff. I don't know. I feel everything wrapped up in this game.
Okay, so Chow, let's assume that it's been a while since I've watched the trailers, or I haven't watched the trailers. Like, oh, a new Atelier game, and it's a new series. What does that mean? Like, out, like, just kind of tee us up. Like, what sort of game this is? Is it an open world action RPG?
Is it open world? So when I know the Atelier games just from, you know, a distance here, I know they've been getting more and more like open. So it's like this game open world, like, I don't know, Final Fantasy 15 or something like that, where it's, you can just kind of, you just have a big world to just kind of pick a direction and go.
Basically. But yeah, you just have to go to your Atelier to start out the game. Once you play the introduction scene, which is kind of like a flash forward, which not many Atelier games does. I think this is the first one that did the flash forward. Most game usually starts with this, like the main character is like from some humble town, and they will say that their full name is something something, but it's shortened to their title name, you know. So usually that's how every like Atelier game starts, but this one starts with a flash forward to show you that, oh, this is a darker, serious. It's like we're taking this serious.
So it's like a more action packed. Like, hey, when you hit new game, it's like you're already in the middle of the action. I assume there's like the tutorial section. Something happens in that flash forward, which is like a cliffhanger. Then it like. You're saying it goes, and then it goes like, it flashes back to like, hey, how did we get there moment?
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Okay. How it starts.
Okay. So very Hollywood-esque. sounds like.
But yeah, once you go to your Atelier, it basically becomes an open world. You can just do whatever you want. And the game is pretty hands-off. It won't tell you. It's like once a tutorial pop once, it'll never pop in again. You'll literally have to open the menu to search for a tutorial if you missed it, right?
So I know there's a bit tricky to answer on an audio-based podcast, but I guess, you know, not everyone's a fan of open worlds, and maybe some people are like, man, I don't really know if I want an open world for an Atelier game. Like, what's the general size of the open world here, if you can kind of give any sort of, like, comparisons to, like, another game that might be open world? Like, what sort of size of...
compare it to Genshin. I am so sorry. I know people are going to kill me for this, but if you play Genshin, you basically are all very familiar with like how this game works, right? And if I was going to compare it with Genshin, it would be like, oh, this game has 4 regions, but they're not at the scale of Genshin, right? So it'll be like maybe half of Genshin of the 4 regions combined with their 2 regions, I guess. That's how I would look at it.
So if you can do Genshin algebra, you can determine the size of Atelier Yubia.
But I assume, because I know in some of the trailers they showed out, they like eventually Yumiya or the players get some sort of motorcycle. Compared to like you're saying Genshin, would you say like the speed of traversal, whether it's like traveling across land, or I don't know if there's a climbing element to this game, is it like generally slower or faster to navigate?
I say it's much faster because there's no stamina, so you could be always running. And the thing is, what is it? In Genshin, you always run out of stamina. So every like 20 seconds, you're like run out of energy, and your characters will be like jogging again, and then then they're sprinting. It's like it feels such a pain to get to places.
PTSD of Dragon's Dogma. That's why you have ox carts there. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay.
My favorite in Genshin is that when you run and you ran out of stamina and jump in the pool of water, you just instantly die.
Okay, let's shift a little bit of perspectives here, because maybe people don't know or have played Genshin. So I'll put the same question to James, and to James, how close or far away is this to say something like Xenoblade X when it comes to open world size and traversal?
It's actually pretty similar, I'd say, to Xenoblade in terms of scope. I feel like it's definitely smaller than Xenoblade Cross.
Okay.
But I think the best way to describe the open world is that I'm pretty sure Chow and I are on the same page about like how the game handles being an open world game. But I don't think the scope of the world is a problem. If anything, I think it's like the perfect size for what it's trying to be.
So it doesn't feel like there's a million billion miles between interesting things.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the game overstays its welcome. It's like, I got the game done pretty... I post my playtime in the staff channel. I don't think my playtime was too extreme.
What was your playtime?
My clear time was 32 hours.
Okay, that's basically, you've cleared like... How much optional stuff is like? Is that like 100%?
Not like 100%. It's like a 60% with each region. It's like normally it's like when you reach like 50%, you're basically done with that region, basically. Unless you want to go full 100% for the trophy, right? And get everything.
So not quite critical path only, but not exhaustive. So somewhere in the middle, that's where you ended up at 30-some hours.
I also feel like, okay, so I got the game, and I got like 9 days to finish it. Right, so that's basically when the code came in, and you're like, oh, it's like, so I will stay up at this time. So I had to rush the last region because of like the embargo date, right?
Okay,
that's kind of like what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. It happens to everyone.
The circumstances behind every game in terms of time allowing and how much you can put in are different depending on when you get the code, the scope of the game. What the critical path versus the 100% path, like the difference between those two extremes is, because for some games it's very broad, and for some games it's not very different.
Okay, so this question is for both James and you, Chow. So I know a lot of people going to this game have probably played through the Ryza games, and like I guess that's going to be the easiest way to like talk about this, given like what can players who played the Ryza trilogy expect out of Yumiya? Do you think it's like a big, big departure, or do you think it's like it's leading go for it, James.
I'd say that's very different, because like Ryza, especially like 2 and 3, had way more of a story focus, whereas Yumiya, while there is a story, it feels like it's really kind of not a focus until the latter half of the game, and even then it's conceptually, like, if you wrote down the story on paper, I think that they could have done a lot better job at selling it. But I think Chow and I are on the same page, where it's like, you can tell this game had a higher budget than Atelier games normally have, but maybe not quite high enough to, like, stick the landing for the story that they were trying to tell.
Like, they got lots of interesting premises here, but I felt there's not a lot of it. And also the villains in this game, you only like meet them 3 times in the entire game. One of the main villains that you meet, it's like, oh, you meet them once and you meet them again, then the next time you meet them, you just kill them.
Also, and I can't say specifically about what, but there's a specific plot point that happens near like the latter half of the game that on paper, it's really interesting that deals with Yumiya, but the game it feels weird how the game eventually like comes to its conclusion about it, and I can't say anything more than that, and I think Chow knows what specifically I'm alluding to, but we can't talk about it.
Do you think the gameplay alone is like is enough to like kind of hook people in to, and the, where, like, the story shortcomings coming from seems like?
The synthesis system is good, but my main problem with Yumiya's like gameplay is that, just frankly, as an open world, it doesn't have nearly enough to do that's different each time. Because like the gameplay loop is basically, okay, here's these question marks on the map, go to them and you'll find either a, like, I don't know, like not an orb, but like a hexahedron or whatever it's called. And it's like you can activate that to get skill points, and that's something. Or there's a tower that you can activate that turns it into a fast travel point. Or there's a shrine of prayer, which every shrine of prayer is the exact same thing. You get three lights going out directing you to different like pedestals that you need to activate. And the way you activate them is by doing the same mini game you're going to do like dozens of times throughout the game, to either activate those pedestals or to activate zip lines. And I think I would have liked the open world a lot more if there was any more variety in what you were doing for those puzzles or those shrines of prayer. If each time you went to a shrine of prayer, you didn't, if each time you went to a shrine of prayer, you weren't knowing that you were going to be doing the exact same thing, I might have actually have done more of them.
I think the main issue is like the more you play it, the more you dislike it, because by the time you like done the first region, you basically experience all there is to offer the game.
You know what's coming to mind for me as you talk about this? Forspoken.
Yeah. I hate to say it.
I have that installed. I want to play it.
I hate to say it, but that is a really good comparison point to how this open world feels. And that's not a good feeling.
Oh, man. Okay.
It kind of feels like you're describing developer's first open world game.
And the thing that's crazy is, though, is that, like, Chow, did you play Rise of Three?
Not fully. I only played the introduction, but I know that they were trying to do a more open world kind of scale.
But the thing with Rise of Three is that the way that its open zones were designed, which to be fair is not very different from the way that like Yumiya's open world is, because each region is basically segmented and there's like a thin path that goes from one to the other for the most part. Rise of Three's open world open zones felt a lot better, because even though there was not really that many puzzles, the way the regions were designed, they wrapped in on itself. There was like way more variety in what you were doing and how things looked. And it feels like, in a weird sort of way, since they made this be a proper open world, it kind of hamstrung like what they could do with it.
Yeah.
And to
I don't
be
know about
clear,
you guys, but from you go ahead, then I'll talk.
To be clear, though, like, visually, I think that's not the problem with Yumiya's open world. I think visually, especially the second region, is really, really neat. And I could definitely see a world where if they had just done a few small tweaks, it would have been really, really engaging. So I think that the next Yumiya game, which, spoiler alert, it's 100% obvious they're going to do the same thing, where it's like, we are no longer having the thing where Atelier trilogies for each trilogy, that each game would be a separate protagonist. It's very clear at the end of this game that Yumiya will return. So,
well, I'm not surprised, because it's worked out for them so well with the last trilogy in terms of just series mindshare, having that one character that they can kind of tether to their series to for 5 years or whatever.
Yeah. I don't think that's necessarily a problem. Just I do know some people were disappointed that we didn't get new protagonists in the Secret Trilogy, right, and it was just all on Ryza. And it's, again, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know. I feel like Chow probably feels the same way. So you see that ending, it's like, that is very clearly this is the MacGuffin that they're going to focus on in the next game.
Yeah, I could see that point of view. I also feel like there's, I don't know, I feel there's some closure that kind of needed. So it's like there's still a lot of plot threads.
And like part of that, I feel like, is tied to that one thing that's kind of weird that they deal with her character in the game. But on the other hand, it feels like they kind of try to say that it's taken care of and it's weird, but we can't talk about it. So it's just
Brian, what you were going to say earlier.
I was just going to say it's just a tangent. Like, I've never really seen like the huge this dividing line or distinction between this is an open map. You can go anywhere from anywhere versus a map with large but segmented zones. Like, I think of Monster Hunter Wilds, where it's like they are technically connected, but is anyone actually walking from the wastelands to the forest through like the one narrow path?
That's my primary method to get to hunt. That's it.
Yeah, like, quest NPC is like everywhere. Like, but the quest is like so minor, you probably don't even want to like interact with them, right? They just like fuck like pointless thing. Like, this NPC is being attacked by monsters. You save them, you get skill points, or you help them like do some kind of task. I want some healing items, please give me that. You get some skill points. So there are people out there, but they're kind of feel like they're just tacked on.
It's one of those things. Like, you design the game to have this thing, and like you're taking of your development process is with this certain feature in mind, like Monster Hunter Wilds, for example. Your whole development process and the way you design this game is like one of the big selling features. Like, this on all connected world that like you can seamlessly go from map to map. And then, so you design a lot of like the technologies and the way that you're implementing them in the game from the technical side around that, just for people to be like, okay, you see it once in the low rank story and never go through those corridors again. So it's like, you know, this is getting back to Monster Hunter Wilds, and I won't dwell on it, but it's like one of those things, like, you really sacrificed probably some element of your resources just for a thing that people will experience once because it's mandatory in the low rank storyline and never interact with it again because they're just going to be teleporting all over the place anyway, because that's the most efficient way to, you know, get from place to place in that game, because you want to do stuff.
I also want to
mention, if you tell me that Ryza 3 has like well made, you know, plenty to do, large enough, interesting zones, but are technically disconnected, versus Yumiya, so you have four sectors, and they're technically connected, but they're samey and don't have enough to do. Like, I know which one of those I'm going to pick. I'm going to pick the segmented one that's better implemented.
It's like think about like Guiding Lands in Iceborne, you know? It's like different biomes, and you can get to them because they're all relatively close. You're not like, you know, it's not like an obstacle, or it doesn't feel like a super waste of time to go travel to them right away, because like they're all relatively close to each other instead of like separated, segmented long corridors, you know. So it's still effectively disconnected. You just want to have that technical tagline of like everything seamlessly connected. It's like, kinda, sort of.
That can be good, but it's not inherently better if it's not implemented well. Yeah. Anyways, right about the Monster Hunter tangent. For me, it's like, we haven't talked about Monster Hunter yet. Like, oh wait, yeah, you guys did. My bad. Anyways, sorry, Chow.
Yeah. I was going to say, one thing I really hate about like doing like story quests in this. It's like, oh, come meet me and talk to me privately in this place. And then your character teleports like 6,000 miles across the map. It's like, do you have to do that?
That's trending?
You know what I'm saying?
There's a lot of things where it's like, head back to the atelier. And it's like, technically you can do synthesis wherever, because you have the base building stuff, which I did not.
I was going to ask about that. Like, is the base building like you have to start from scratch every time you enter a new region? Like,
I'm confused
how that's implemented.
So the way it works is that now when you gather items, you also gather materials that are like, basically for every category of item, you also get materials connected to that, or almost every category of item.
Okay.
And then you can use those materials, which are separate from your items, which you use for synthesis, to be able to make like furniture or walls or whatever for a base. And the way that the open world is structured is that there's these different pedestals in each zone, which once you get to them, you can interact with them to clear out the mana bound area around, so that you don't have any. So this game is obviously not time gated like previous Atelier games were. Instead, what they have, which is kind of, it feels like, meant to be like an all like an like a
Russian fucking blocker.
yeah, progression. Well, not even progression blocker, more of like a like an olive branch to the folks that liked the time limits, is that when you're in an area that is mana bound, you have this resource called energy, which as you're exploring, it's depleting, and you need to basically either find these flowers to replenish it as you're going through, but also your ultimate goal is to get to one of those pedestals to clear out the mana bound area so you don't have to worry about your energy anymore when you're exploring that section of the map.
I never run out of this energy. That's the thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I never ran out of it once. And it's like, even like you can upgrade how much energy you can have, but I never felt like I needed to, because it never ever felt like I was in danger of running out.
So I don't know what the consequences of running out this resource. They just tell you it's bad, and then that's like, okay. But it's like, it's always like there's areas to refill it all over the place. You're just wondering, it's like, should I have to worry about this?
But anyways,
like they want the constraint in place, and they don't want to inconvenience you though.
Yeah, so the base building, it's like, here, you can make your own base, but the problem is that there's like no real reason to, instead of just using like one of the presets, because the benefits you get from it is so minuscule. And while there is a lot of options to work with, I feel like until you get to the end of the game, there's not enough options to actually make your base feel that unique. And again, it doesn't really matter. It feels like they made this precisely because the Soysan, the Gus president, really loves survival crafting games. So he's like, oh, let's try and do this. And it doesn't feel like it adds anything to the game at all.
Does that like feed into the base building? Like, I'm still not sure like what the base building serves in the overall purpose, or is it just an aesthetic thing?
It's mostly an aesthetic thing. The main reason why you would want to engage with base building is at all is to make like a forge to like be able to duplicate some of your synthesized equipment or items, or to be able to synthesize like duplicate some of your best like synthesis materials that you found, or stuff like that. But that's not base building. And in fact, when you like use presets, that'll say it's a separate thing. Technically, you can also build stuff that's different from that, but it's just, I don't know. It's like, I enjoyed my time with Yumiya, but the more I think about it, the more it's like, man, they've got a lot they need to fix up or polish up for the next game. Cause it's like, there's potential here to make something really, really special, and you can see glimpses of it. But the more you sit back and look at the whole picture, it's like, man, maybe they didn't need to go open world. Maybe they didn't need to have this focus on crafting that obviously took up a lot of development resources, when the end result is it doesn't really add anything to the game.
I was like, okay, just auto synthesis. Okay, S rank items. Like, why do I have to use my brain when I can just use the computer?
And that's the thing that's messed up, is that the synthesis system in Yumiya is really fun, but it doesn't feel as in depth as, say, something like even Ryza, which was itself not super in depth compared to like synthesis systems of the past. But there was more to engage with at any given time. And the way the synthesis works in Yumiya is that since it's an open world game, you're just constantly gathering so many materials. You eventually get to the point where it's like, you have so many items, it's impossible to remember what you exactly have. And at a point, like, I made a point to not use auto synthesis, but once you get to the end game and you're like, have recipes that are like max level 10, you basically have to just be like, okay, let them auto add for synthesis, and then I'll go in and replace stuff to fill in the cracks that the auto synthesis was not able to do. Because otherwise, this takes so long, but it doesn't feel like there's any actual strategizing to it. I don't know.
That feels like very poorly implemented. Yeah, the way that the economy works in that, the way that you're describing it. But yeah, at some point, I'm sure it's all like most people are gonna like just let the game think for me, because it's everything feels so bloated.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened with me. It's like, I wanted to keep doing everything manually, but the game has so much bloat to it in the first place that it's like, I'm not going to force myself, because this game, it's funny. Ryza 2 and 3, based off my playtime, were longer than this. Probably if you do everything Yumiya, it's going to be longer than Ryza 2. But Ryza 3 was longer than this game for me, not a question. And even though I thought that game was a little bit bloated, in retrospect, it doesn't feel anywhere as bloated as Yumiya does, a game that is effectively half its length.
So now that you mentioned Ryza 3, I guess one of the big questions that we should probably address is, like, how is the, at least from what you guys played, the state of localization in this game?
Ryza 3 was infamous. It is significantly better. I would say that if you were someone that played Ryza 3 and got burned by the localization, I even asked about this when I went to the preview event. It's like, hey, I just brought it up because of the situation with that. And they told me at the time, oh, don't worry, we put an extra amount of care into the localization. You shouldn't have any problems. And it's like, when you're at a preview event, you kind of, it's like, yeah, I'll see for myself once I actually get the full game. Yeah, this game's localization, as far as like Atelier goes, this is probably the best they've done for localization probably ever. Okay. I don't have any issues with the quality of the localized text. There might be one or two things if I really like put it under a microscope, like maybe there's a systems text that got slightly mistranslated or something, but I was keeping an eye out for things, and I didn't, unlike Ryza 3, where it was incredibly obvious that there was something wrong with the localization, in this case, it's like, no, there's nothing wrong with the locals. Like, the localization itself is fine, and the text itself reads well, and it seems like, yes, they did put extra focus on the localization this time. I don't know how Chao feels about it.
I feel it's fine. I feel like they should start dubbing the series again. I feel like any localizations like with a dub, it's like an improvement, because they, like, while they're dubbing, it's like, oh, this sounds kind of unnatural to say, and they could correct it, right?
You say that, but the original release of Ys8 was also dubbed.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, and there's also, like, you know, the problem of dub titles as well. Like, it's something that the Yakuza series even had to, like, Sega went out of their way to correct for, where they have a different set of, like, subtitles if you're using the Japanese audio versus English voices. So they have dub titles, so they actually do correct the subtitles per audio track in those games.
I will say my barometer for the localization is that there's like one line that essentially the final boss says, that if anyone is familiar with Japanese, they'll see this one, like, they'll hear the Japanese voice line, they'll hear the one specific word he uses, and they'll look at the localization and be like, oh, they didn't fall into that trap where everyone uses the exact same translation for this word, when really half the time it does not fit whatsoever, and they actually properly conveyed what the hell he was saying in that one line. It's like, okay, that
it can't be helped.
No, it's like, I won't forgive you. I won't allow this, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like that, Yudusanai, like, they actually properly translated that instead of just falling into that one trap. So it's like, when I saw that, it's like the whole game, I was like, this feels like the localization is a step up from previous games. And I saw it, it's like, yep, they definitely put more care into this localization.
Since we haven't talked about it yet, you know, a lot of the reason that people like to play these games is obviously for the characters. How's the new cast this time around?
I like it. I feel like it wouldn't be too fair to Yumiya's cast to say that. Well, what's the best way of putting this? I really liked Rutger
is my favorite out of the,
yeah,
out of the six.
It is very, very obvious, and they'll probably follow up on it in the next
game. Is he the dude with, like, the green jacket with the scythe?
Yes, yeah. It's very, very obvious that Rutger is, if anything, probably going to be the love interest throughout the rest of the trilogy, would be my guess. Because there's already, like, even before like a climatic event in the game, like it felt like the interactions that Yumiya has with him in his like side stories are a lot more in depth than the other characters, and it really does stand out. And then something happens in the story that directly draws a parallel between Yumiya and Rutger, which wasn't there before necessarily. And it just, and in the story, there's like moments that you see Rutger like actually do and say things. It's like, yeah, it feels like he's meant to be that sort of character. I don't know if Chao feels the same way.
I probably don't see him as a love interest, but I do feel that he has like some plot points that could set up for further things. I think we could actually like talk about it because that's not past that point.
Well, if it's about the Yumiya stuff, we can't talk about it, but we can talk about his stuff.
Basically, what happened is like they asked him, like, why he's acting all kind of like is it awkward or is it kind of annoyed all the time? It's like because like he's saying that like back then when he was a war orphan, somebody came up to him and said, "Hey, I'll buy your memories." It's like, okay, I'll sell my memories. And after that, it's like he seems to regret it because he always feels like something's missing in his head. Whoa. It's like
he doesn't say he regrets it because he says, like, it sucked. I shouldn't have had to have done that, but it was the best option at the time because otherwise the orphan, like him and the other orphans, would have starved.
Yeah, I don't want to get too like into story because obviously no one in like people want to see this for themselves.
The only thing I'll say is that like when I was talking about how I feel like there's a lot of concepts that Yumiya has that had a lot of promise, even if it wasn't fully delivered on. Like the main thing is that obviously the subtitle is Atelier Yumiya, the Alchemist of Memories. The way that alchemy works in this game is it is like essentially like fully magic this time, in the sense that the way that the world works is that there's mana, and it's kind of like a life stream type deal where mana itself is like imbued with the memories of anything that it used to be. And so the way that alchemy works is that you, like, if you have memories of what something used to be, you can manipulate mana into basically making whatever is connected to that memory. So the way that you find new, like, synthesis recipes is by finding memory, like, crystals in order to get, like, memories of, like, stuff that was synthesized in the past in the Alodisian Empire. And then that's how you basically figure out your new recipes and you go from there. But in the story, like we said, the whole thing is that memories are also part of your soul, because if mana is like your life energy, it's like part of your soul. And if you lose memories, you're losing a part of your soul.
It sounds like Kingdom Hearts.
Yeah, I guess, but not in a bad way. I think the whole idea of it, like of how alchemy works in this one, in this game, and the idea of like mana and how it like interacts with memories in the soul is interesting. Just it definitely feels like something that they're going to have to expand on a bit more in the future. Cause like with the way things are left, it's like, okay, is this thing actually completely done, or are they going to go back and do something else with it, or so on and so forth? Man, I can't talk about that one story moment like near the end, but it, like, the more I think about it, the more weird it feels with how they frame it. But
that feels like a missed opportunity. That's what I feel.
Yeah.
But well, again, how do you guys feel about Yumiya as a protagonist? Just like personality, characterization,
I think
agency,
she is,
those things.
I think she is good, but unfortunately, with how weird things are with that like later story moment, it's kind of hard to say. There's a lot of room for her to grow still, but it's, I don't know how they're like, which direction they're going to take things. And that's a good thing in one sense. It's like, wow, I don't know what's going to be next. But it's also like with Ryza, you kind of had an idea, like a broad sense of which way she was going by the end of the first game. But I don't really know specifically which way Yumiya is going to go. And I feel like a lot of her character development has already possibly happened, which, I mean, that was the same thing with Ryza, but I don't know. I like Yumiya. I like it. I like her as a character, but it definitely feels like a situation where I really need to see how they follow things up on her in the next games before I know for sure how I feel about her, like, compared to other series protagonists.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to
frustrated.
Go for it.
Sorry, like frustrated is too negative of a connotation, but it's like, man, like, what is this event that happens that contextualizes things? But I've played games where it's like all the story beats independently or even in sequence work, make sense, or cogent, but only if the outcome happens a certain way, then the outcome fumbles it, and it's like it almost retroactively recontextualizes things for the worst. But I understand kind of the idea of having piece in place.
I don't even necessarily think that they fumbled it per se, because there's still a chance that they can follow up on things. But I'm going to say something that isn't a spoiler in and of itself, but some people might be able to. What I'll say is that when I was at the preview event, Hasoi-san directly told me that for the relationship between Yumiya and Flamie, that he was inspired by the relationship between Cortana and Master Chief. And when he said that, as someone that has played Halo and is familiar with the story a bit, I was wondering exactly what he meant by that. And let's say I got an answer to that by the end of the game.
Yumiya is an AI created construct.
No.
But, I wouldn't want to know either way. I'm going to let people see that for themselves, see, you know, how they feel about it.
I was in a voice chat with a friend of mine last night as I was finishing up, and I was explaining to her what Hasoi-san had said, and then very briefly what had just happened, and she just started cackling because she's also played the Halo games, and we were both on the same page. It's like, oh my god, yeah, that's what he meant.
I did not play Halo, so I don't know where I was going from it. So.
I have played Halo, but besides the, you know, Yumiya being an AI, I don't, without playing Yumiya, I don't know exactly what you're getting at, but I have a slant maybe that I can kind of consider.
It's going to be interesting to see how this lands with fans. It's going to be extremely hard for Lightning to strike twice, because Ryza definitely was that, you know, revival of the series for a lot of people's eyes, and to them, of course. And trying to, like, you know, it's very, they're very much trying to posture, you know this new mainline series of games in a post-Ryza world. So, you know, like we already mentioned, like having that singular main character on, like, the previous mainline series, and now they're very much, like, you know, trying to market Yumiya as, like, you know, she's like the next, she's Ryza's successor, she's the new poster girl, and so forth. And we'll see how that, you know, it's going to be really difficult for them to really try to follow up on that and try to capture the same success. I guess we haven't really followed up or touched up on this yet, but, like, you guys mentioned this is now, like, a fully action RPG, and, like, every time I see, like, videos of the combat, it's like over the shoulder third person, and I can't tell, like, how active the combat is versus, like, what is being done and, like, being chosen because it's just, like, when you view the combat and not playing it, it's hard to parse, like, what you're actually doing input wise in combat when you're seeing
it's like
videos.
Once you play it, all
it's even though it's a very different combat system from Rise of One, it has a very similar issue where it doesn't feel like the items make a lot of sense to use most of the time. And it also doesn't make a lot of sense to switch between your party members, which was very much a problem that Rise of One had in both measures. I've read Chao's reviews, so I know we're on the same page here. This combat system is not good. It is very button spam. Like, it's very, like, button spammy. And
so are you just like mashing normal attack and then, like, better than pressing immediately?
I could not understand most of the mechanics, and I got through every single boss fight or every single fight no problem, just button mashing. And even the boss kills my characters, I perfect dodge everything. It's like, you can't hurt me. I perfect dodge all your attacks. So it's like,
yeah, there's that, but also, like, because of the issues I was having, where it's like it felt like these. Full disclosure, I started off the game on hard difficulty because I wanted to feel like I had a challenge. And then I got to the boss of the second region and I was like, wait a second, I just instantly demolished them. Guess I need to bump this up to very hard. And even then, once I got to the final boss, and because of how easy it is in any Atelier game to eventually just make broken equipment, I loaded up my entire party with quality level 999 equipment with augmentations on all of my gear with stats boost plus level 10. And I just went into the final boss and it's like, man, you can't do anything. You have a lot of health, but you're not hurting me at all.
Okay, so the last boss gave me a little bit of trouble just because I didn't upgrade any of the gear in the last region because I just want to straight up just go straight to the last boss and just get the story done.
Yeah, Chowder's just like, I'm done with this game. I just want to get it done.
I mean, he was so
yeah.
Have like basically gear from the last region.
Chow, random question. Did you ever find out how to recipe recall bismuthium or however you pronounce it? The rainbow ingot?
No, I don't know where to find the flower.
Well, not the flower, but the like ore or whatever, because it's like,
oh, I got the recipe, but I did not know where to find that flower. I found the flower in a treasure chest from a treasure trove, and then I got the recipe that way. But I couldn't find any extra flowers, so I couldn't really like, you know, get the
recipe. Yeah, I ran into an issue where I found the ingot in like a treasure trove, so I got the recipes for that gear, but I was never able to find the other thing I needed to actually recall and synthesize it myself. Yeah, and so then I got to the final region. It's like, okay, well, I know how to make the final region's ingot, so I guess I'm completely skipping the third region's ingot, even though I like looked everywhere to try and find it. I even went to the extra like zone up north, and it's like I just couldn't find it.
Place a flower.
I don't think it was a flower, but it was like something. It's like I just couldn't
find it.
Smells
like age or something. It's like it looks like a flower to me. It's like I don't know where the hell to find it. It's like at the end of the game, I was like, okay, well, I guess I'll just make the strongest weapon instead. And for some reason, the strongest weapons have an easier material to farm, and they also, they require fishing for some reason? Like two of the ultimate
weapons. Some of them, yeah, they require fishing, yeah.
So, which is kind of odd. It is what it is. And I don't know where to find those two fishes to get the strongest spear and the strongest sickle for.
And Chow, you played it on, you did play it on PC, so yeah, it might have been a PC bug then. I don't know. But, one thing I'll also mention, I guess, since I brought up we both played it on PC. You said you had crashing issues on your like AMD RDNA 3 GPU. Like you have a 7800 XT and you had some crashing issues apparently.
Yeah, it usually happens every time when you're in the loading screen. Even when I beat the game, it asks you like, hey, do you want to save a clear save file? It's like, okay, save, crash. It's like, okay. It usually happens when you see a loading screen. That's for me, right?
Yeah, thankfully, I didn't have any crashes whatsoever, and because I've been over the last week and a half, I've been at my parents watching their cat while they're out of country, and so I put like 30 hours into the game on my laptop, which is also AMD based with a 6800M, and I'm looking at the AMD software right now, and it said playtime total 31 hours, and I didn't have a single crash. So
weird.
I think it's just an RDNA 3 thing. It's not unexpected, because Koei Tecmo has definitely had issues with RDNA 3 stuff in the past. Fun fact, they're the reason why I switched my desktop to NVIDIA, because Wolong and then Wild Hearts both had issues with RDNA 3 cards on Windows, and it was just a situation where once I upgraded my laptop to an AMD laptop, because it was the only one I could get that would have more than 8 gigabytes of VRAM for under $1,000.
Man, if I could only hold out for another 2 years and got the 9070 XT instead.
That seems like it's probably the best card to get if you're not going fully top of the line. But even if you are going fully top of the line, you're not getting a 5090 for anything less than $3,000 anytime soon. It's like, yeah. But
what can I say?
Yeah, just a tangent. I figured it was worth mentioning because in your review, you did mention the crashing issues. And I wanted to stress that it seems like it's not even just AMD. Neither of us obviously have an RDNA 4 card to test, so we don't know if the crashing is also a problem on like a 9070 XT. But on RDNA 2, so like a 6800 XT or 6900 XT or 6700 XT, you should be fine, because like the Steam Deck doesn't have any issues, and that's RDNA 2 based, and I haven't had any issues on my laptop, which is, again, 6800M, which is essentially just the 6700 XT.
I assume generally, like, the performance is generally all right, and like, yeah, has a decent, yeah, amount of PC options to tweak with.
Yeah, like, in my preview, I mentioned it was interesting how it doesn't have DLSS or FSR, but it does have XeSS. That's, like, the one quirk about the port, and I'd say okay, that the port itself is really good.
Okay.
I didn't use keyboard and mouse controls too much, but it has really good keyboard and mouse controls. Like, the menus are fully, like, mouse. You can use the mouse for everything, and even, like, the little, like, mini games I was complaining about earlier, you can use the mouse in those mini games, which makes them way easier, way quicker to do.
The mouse controls are good, but there's one thing I do not know how to do with the keyboard. I do not know how to open the house building menu on a keyboard, so I had to go back to a controller.
I think it was like F4 or something.
F4 out of all fun buttons. Okay.
Okay.
Something like that. Because the thing is that when you're in the base building and it's like, here's the preset menu, normally it says use the I don't know what the name of the button is. The Xbox button that's like three lines. It says to use that, and then, like, I think if you have if you're using keyboard and mouse controls, it'll also let you know which button you need to press for that, and I think it's F4, but if it's not, it'll let you know.
Yeah. Okay. I did not know, because certain times I did try playing on the keyboard, because I was like, it's like, let me try to use a gun on the keyboard. It's going to be much easier to aim for shit with a keyboard, so I did that, and I'm like, yeah, this feels great. It's like, aiming on a controller, I feel, is too sensitive. I had to, like, lower the sensitivity
down
to, like, 2 before it's, like, workable. Or else the thing just moves like a fucking mouse with your right hand stick, right?
Yeah, and I'd say the game is well-optimized. Like, besides, like, the crashing issues, I'm sure you had no problems, like, maxing this game out. And it...
No, the game runs smooth in my end. I'm sure it's a pretty taxing game, but I can't really say because I didn't have dips. I have heard, like, different reviewers complain about the performance, that this game feels kind of like very demanding and unoptimized for certain players, because I certain review, they seem to all have like 3060 cards for some reason. I feel like that's the most common card for in the industry, probably.
The thing is that I wouldn't see how that would, like, seeing how the game runs on my laptop at 1440p on the high preset, and then XeSS just knocked down to Ultra Quality Plus instead of like native. I put a 60 FPS frame cap because I felt like I was like CPU limited, so I wouldn't go really that much higher above that, and it felt like it made sense just to cap it at 60. And I didn't have any issues with performance on my laptop. Obviously, I'm not even going to talk about like what I played of it on my desktop, because that's, again, no point even bringing that up. But
Now, one thing that is worth bringing up is kind of one of the news things for this week as we head into the launch is the demo will be available within a day, probably by the time this podcast is published, just ahead of the release, which does have a Steam demo as well, which sometimes Steam gets skipped, but this will have a demo, and it'll be interesting to see like people's, you know, a wider population of people being able to report whether they have performance issues, crashing, and things like that.
Yeah, so for people who don't know, there's going to be a demo for Atalia Yumiya either March 16 or March 17, depending on time zone, for PS5, PS4, Switch, Xbox, I assume that's Xbox Series and Xbox One, and Steam, so all platforms. And then you can take the same data from the demo into the full game. So obviously, this could be like from the very beginning of the game up to a certain point. So if you're interested in checking out a lot of like what James and Chow have been talking about in terms of like gameplay, make up your own mind.
I think a lot of Twitter comments kind of think that it's like, oh, this guy's over leveled, so he probably doesn't know what he's talking about. Or certain people say that the combat is hard in certain reviews because there's a huge difficulty spike, and you're like, and this guy just breezed through it. It's like, he surely does not know what he's talking about. It's like,
I mean,
you can't win.
I could totally see that if you don't engage with the synthesis system, especially if you're playing on harder difficulty, if you'll find like a difficulty spike. But the last couple of bosses of the game, definitely there is a spike. I noticed that, but it wasn't a problem for me because I walked in with a gun that was specifically crafted to kill a god and basically just,
it wasn't a problem for me because I walked in with a gun.
This reminds me of like the pro ZD, like fighting the final boss after finding all the pine cones or whatever.
That's the funny thing is that I didn't even like do everything. I did like probably a little bit more in Chao, but not that much more. It's just that if you've ever played an Atelier game before, it's very, very easy to realize the loop of, okay, how do I make the most busted equipment imaginable? And then do just that.
Yeah, that's definitely a series that. Experience thing. Like, if you're just going into it like as a newcomer and you don't engage with like the one of the main systems, which is, you know, the Atelier, you know, alchemy part of it, then yes, you know, definitely feel the difficulty spike because you're
one
of the core pillars of the series.
So basically, the setup I had at the end of the game is I found an accessory that would, every time I did a skill, which is every time you attack, because technically your cooldowns are skills, a percentage of the damage you deal will be recovered as health. And I basically got one of those fully maxed out with an augment that just fully buffed it and also reduced my skill cooldowns. And then I got another accessory that its skills were to make it so that your kind of mana burst, it extends how long it lasts and makes it so that you lose less of the gauge quickly, but also the longer you're in it, the stronger it gets. And one of the trade-offs for your mana burst is that you can stay in it as long as you want, but as soon as you expend your mana, your environmental mana, you'll start losing HP. But remember how I said that I got an accessory that made it that every time I attacked, I recovered HP. Because of how strong I made my weapon, every single time I attacked, I fully recovered my HP. And it meant that I could just get into the mana burst and just stay there and keep attacking. And then by the end, like at the very end of the final boss, before the like a cutscene, like finisher for it, like I did the special mana burst attack and I ended up doing like for every tick of that attack, and there's like 30 ticks, I think, of it, I was doing like 40 to 50,000 damage and recovering 3,000 plus health. And
no, I was not having that experience. I was doing 2 to 200 damage.
Yeah, I just found out like, hey, these two accessories seem to synthesize really well together. I'm going to make myself absurdly broken. And then I did.
And that's kind of what that Atelier experience too. So like the system allows for that, like in many Atelier games where you can just like, it is by design that you make broken shit.
But it's like, I actually did want to see what it's like if you didn't come in with all broken gear. Because I feel like the battle system has potential in like during boss fights. I mean, there was like a rotating AOE marker. It's like shit like that. It's like you want to see what they do. But like half the time, they just fucking die like in a split second. You don't know what they do, right? Like I feel the battle system is way too imbalanced. You just level way too quickly, and like the fights are like never ever difficult, right? And random encounter is just like button spammy. It's like you just press one button and they're dead, right? You like never learn how to actually like play the game for real, right? At least that's my experience with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tale of two extremes. It's like it seems like with Atelier, it's like you learn the system in and out, so you learn how to make broken shit organically, or you kind of hit that wall or feel like you're not, you know, you're doing piss damage because you're not making the broken shit. It never seems like you're finding like a middle ground build in these games, you know.
It's one of those things where having perfect balance shouldn't always be a goal. Having a little bit of imbalance is fine, but if you just stumble across being broken without like any thought, or in Chao's case, you're not really that broken, but still you just kind of press buttons and win. Well, yeah, I guess Chao, what difficulty were you playing on?
I'm playing on normal. I play all games on normal until I beat it, then I play on very hard. Or unless I'm writing a guide for some reason and I decided to go nightmare first try kind of thing. It'll be like, I think the only game that I ever start on like a nightmare first try was Trails to Azure. I actually wrote a guide on that with no help. Just go straight to nightmare from the get-go. because I want to write what my experience was like trying to beat it. And so if that strategy did not work on Nightmare, then obviously my strategy is completely useless then. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much covers, like, you know, a good chunk of like what people could expect out of Atelier Yumiya. Like, both Chao and James are like, they feel like it's okay overall. You know, it definitely has some fundamental flaws to it, but it's definitely the start of a new series. So hopefully they can only go up from here and fix, you know, some of the core issues that you guys were having with the game. Not to say that it's bad, it's just like, you know, they went a different route and hopefully they learned from their mistakes in installment.
So, of course, Chao does have the review up on the site for Atelier Yumiya at rpgsite.net. And then we have some companion features that went up at the same time. Mikhail did the comparison between some of the consoles, like Switch and PS4 versus PS5, as well as the Steam Deck ROG Ally article. If you're going to play on a portable PC, what sort of things you can get. And then, of course, the like Josh said, we have the demo will be available within a day or two, depending on your time zone.
I wonder how far they will let you go in the demo. It's like, they let you explore the entire first region? It'll be like, oh, it's like you basically got the good chunk of the game then.
Will it even prevent you from, like, is there going to be, like, an invisible wall preventing you from going further? Because it felt like for, like, I don't know how that demo is going to be structured. I'm very curious.
So, I'm not sure about you, James.
The early main quest, pioneering the Lignus region. So,
I was gonna say, James, were you one of those kind of players where you have no idea how to reach certain areas and you just chose the way of falling off the cliff to get there? Were you one of those guys?
Yeah.
Okay. Guess I mean, there was the same boat.
And I found out eventually, once you get the bike, it's like you don't even have to worry about your energy, because if you're on the bike and you fall, you don't take any fall damage.
God mode. Well, I think that kind of covers us for all the games we wanted to talk about this week. What else? I guess we'll go straight into news from here. Not a lot in terms of big headline announcements. Like I said, I was kind of out of the loop. I was pretty much off grid for the last couple of weeks. So I had to kind of tee myself back up when I was reading this, getting prepared for the podcast. What I put at the front here was something that Kite kindly translated for us. This was a Nipponichi Software streaming. Well,
before we go to this, we did have a Rise of the Ronin PC interview that Mikhail did as well. That's like worth shouting out.
Oh, I listed that here and I went right by it. Yeah,
yeah.
I love this interview, especially the one coffee question was great.
Yeah, Mikhail loves putting out the coffee questions for people who either don't drink coffee or they say they don't drink coffee and drink tea instead. So he got to interview Yosuke Hayashi, who's the producer and executive vice president Koei Tecmo, and Fumihiko Yasuda, who's the development producer and head of Team Ninja, on the surrounding, you know, the Rise of the Ronin's PC release that released several days ago. After a rocky start, technically, because like the people have been suffering some issues, and Koei Tecmo has already released a statement saying, hey, we understand that there's some issues. We hope to get out a patch ASAP addressing a lot of those issues that people are having. So, you know, that's a shame that like it launched in that state. And obviously Mikhail wrote up, you know, his impressions of the PC port and like how he was having crashing issues on the Steam Deck and all that. But there's a really, like, you know, it's a pretty brief interview because Yasuda and Hayashi kind of gave more brief answers. But it was nice hearing their perspectives about like the closing gap between console and PC gaming in Japan, and how, like, you know, the PC is becoming more of a fundamental platform that more Japanese developers are focusing on as time goes on. We also learned that Yasuda has been playing a lot of Path of Exile 2 throughout in this time, so very interesting to see that, like, you know, that Path of Exile 2 still in early access, not only having a splash on, like, you know, just the Western player base, but also with some Japanese developers behind the scenes there. So always cool to see, you know, just Japanese developers, you know, playing games on an international scale, not just, you know, within their own region, as a lot of people seem to think. It's like, no, they play games from anywhere in the world, you know, wherever they're developed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really cool to see, like, you know, especially like Yasuda's insight on the soundtracks of the Neo games and how, you know, Yasuda's perspective on Enon Zur, who also did the music for Fallout and Starfield, and all that. So it's a really, really insightful interview that Mikhail did. Interviewing some of the biggest names in Japanese development at the moment. Obviously, coming not just from Team Ninja, but beyond Rise of the Ronin, they're also going to have Ninja Gaiden 4 sometime this year. So it's going to be cool to see, where they go from here, where their experiences lead them with Ninja Gaiden 4 as they co-develop it with Platinum.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of already mentioned this in passing, but I'm really eager to play Rise of the Ronin. Because even though Wolong didn't quite land for me, I do like their Neo team's work. And I know Wolong was kind of like I hate using the term B team, but it was like a younger team that worked on that one. Yeah. So, and then Rise of the Ronin was, again, kind of similar to Yumiya in a small way by going the more open route rather than the more like zone level based route. So see how that is implemented in that game.
Yeah. We just have to hear from you whenever you get around to that game.
Mm-hmm. And then also, before we go back to the news, Adam, did you want to talk about the game that you had kind of played out of your backlog over the last couple of days?
I can spend like 60 seconds on it.
Sure. Go.
So I played System Shock. I played System Shock, the remake that was released in 2023. Mm-hmm. It's one of those games I kind of had been interested in a while, and I just hadn't gotten around to it, and this is a good opportunity to just kind of how the release schedule and other schedules lined up. So this is a System Shock released in 1994, the original version, and it basically eventually was kind of a precursor to things like BioShock after that, right? And System Shock 2, of course. This was a remake from Night Dive, who's, I feel like Night Dive has been pretty busy recently. They've done a lot of different remasters and remakes and new ports and things like that in the last couple of years. But this was one of their bigger projects, being the full remake of System Shock. I've never played the original System Shock. And from what I understand, this is a pretty faithful remake in that a lot of the quirks were maintained. But it is a from the ground up remake. It had a Kickstarter campaign way back in the day. It took a long time for this game to release, and then even longer for it to come out on consoles. It's kind of this like first person, slightly survival horror, slightly immersive sim, even very slightly Metroidvania type of game. It's got a pretty cool visual style. It took me an hour to kind of get used to it, because it's very loud, very cybernetic, very neon colors. Trying to figure out like what's interactable and what's just a texture on the wall, things like that. But once I kind of got used to it, I do like how this game looks. And it's got like, so I grew up, and Brian would know, I kind of grew up as a DOS gamer, like PC gaming back in the 90s. And even though I never played the original version of System Shock, playing this kind of takes me back to that era in a way. It has like this kind of that vibe, that feel. I don't know if you agree at all, Brian, but it's...
No, I kind of get that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of a cool game. I do feel like I spent half my time managing my inventory, because you get like, so it's a first person shooter, but you get like eight or more different weapon types that all take different ammo, and some you don't get a lot of room to hold it all. So a lot of the game is just kind of managing your weapons, your loadout, your ammo. It does have that sort of resource management component to it, and I think it feels like kind of inevitably the way the game is designed, you end up kind of picking a room in the game, just one room, just pick a room, any room, and you just start like dumping stuff in there. Like, all right, I got all my weapons, I can't carry all of them, so I'm just gonna go into this room and just kind of lay them out on the floor here so I can come back and pick them up later if I want. And things like I don't need this much health on me right now, like health packs and things like that, but I might need them later, so I'm going to kind of collect them and drop them off all in here. So I had this little like base that I created. No base building systems, to be clear. Just a bunch of resources and junk I just kind of started dumping in our room. Did you do that too, Brian? I imagine that's probably pretty common.
And one piece of context is that, yeah, ammo you have to make room in your inventory for. It's not just a number on a menu. You've got to hold on to it. And like you said, a lot of different ammo types for different guns. And you can't just say like, well, I only like shotguns. I'm only going to grab the shotgun ammo because you probably won't have enough.
No, you're
like,
going
to
run out.
You have to. Yeah. And that's one of those things that I always harp on where it inconveniences you in a good way where you're like, I really like the shotgun, but I don't have enough shotgun ammo to just use that exclusively. So I have to get the, I don't know, EMP gun. I don't remember.
Actually, kind of the opposite for me. I wasn't a big fan of the shotgun, but when you eventually get to a point where you do have a lot of shotgun ammo, he's like, well, I got to use this. So guess I'm using the shotgun now. So this isn't like a Doom or other classic or full first person games where you can just pick the gun you like for sure.
Speaking of Doom, like one thing I am interested in trying, this is how much of a fossil I am, is I do want to play that Night Dive Doom 1 plus Doom 2, like actual, like, I don't know what the right term is. It's not emulated. It's like re.
Oh, it's not the one that recently released, the newest release.
I don't know how to like the way that was marketed, and I see that the reviews are overwhelmingly positive, is that it's like as faithful as you can get to the original Doom without compromising it, with like making it work on modern systems and modern resolutions without like refiltering it or emulating it. Like I like, if you want to play the original Doom 1 and Doom 2, it seems like the best way to do it.
Yeah, those seem really cool.
I actually forgot that Night Dive was on that, but sure enough, they are.
They do a lot of that stuff. They just like pull up their studio.
Didn't they do the recently, like the Thing remastered or remake as well?
Yeah, they did the Thing remastered. They did Star Wars Dark Forces, which is sort of like Star Wars Wolfenstein. Yeah. Like last year, like maybe a year ago.
Such incredible work.
And then they did like Turok, one of the Turoks. They did. They've done a lot, so
yeah.
I'm actually going through their Killing Time. I'm not very familiar with Killing Time, but that was just last fall, not too long ago. They did a Blade Runner game, and then they like a couple of the classic Turok games. They've done a lot recently, so
so cool.
And then they're coming out with System Shock 2 remastered soon.
So this isn't a full on remake for System Shock 2.
Yeah, I think they basically said that System Shock. That game, I think you can still get the classic version, but that game they felt like it needed the remake treatment. Whereas System Shock 2 came out in 1999, like they think the remaster is kind of good enough, like doesn't need quite the full on from the ground up remake.
That'd be interesting. I remember having a lot of great memories of System Shock 2, but it's been a long time since I replayed it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember loving it.
I will say that having played System Shock after some of the things it inspired, I definitely get more of a modern System Shock feel from things like, and I say modern, even though it's 8-9 years old at this point, Prey versus like BioShock. BioShock really feels kind of different, but Prey to me felt a little bit more like System Shock. Still not quite the same, but I got more of the same like genre vibes.
Right. Something like a spiritual successor in a sense. Yeah.
But yeah, pretty awesome game, not too long. One last question, because I know you said we were going to spend 60 seconds on this. The final boss, because when I played it, it was terrible. Yeah. And then people were just like, oh yeah, that's just how it is. Don't worry about it. It's faithfully bad. Don't worry about it. But I know that they like updated it. And like, I don't know, like, obviously I only played it prior to update. You only played it after update. So we can put our...
I don't know what it was like before.
...together. But was it bad, I guess?
Okay, so the thing about the final boss that's kind of... It kind of commits a cardinal sin, where the cardinal sin is boss design or just really gameplay design that takes out everything that the game has been up to that point and then just changes it, like for like how the game mechanics work. You see this sometimes in various games where it's like this boss has like systems in place that don't work like anything else in the game anywhere and then doesn't return to it at all. So you get to fight Shodan, who's the AI, the rogue AI boss of this game, and the thing is it like takes place in cyberspace, so it doesn't use any of like the weapons or ammo or gameplay that you play through most of the station with, but it also doesn't use the normal cyberspace mechanics that you normally have when you're doing like those different little levels throughout the game. So it's kind of like you get to the final boss and it's like, surprise, here's a new sort of mechanic system to kind of figure out right at the very end of the game, and it's like, whoa, what is this? So it does that, and I consider that a kind of a cardinal sin. But I think they might have made it so, like, the boss has checkpoints in some regard. So if you lose all of your health or, excuse me, integrity in the boss fight, you don't have to start over from the very beginning. I think I might be wrong on that.
I'll have to remind myself at some point later what they actually changed. And, like, I didn't mind that it was bad. Like, so the final boss was kind of a stinker. Oh, well, the rest of the game was great.
I mean, I kind of didn't. It took me a while to figure out what I was doing, but even then I was able to succeed. So it must have not have been that hard if I, like, I sort of expected going into it, like, okay, the first time I try this, I'm going to fail, but I'm going to kind of figure out how it works, and then I'll kind of eventually get it. But no, I beat it on my first try, even not really knowing what I was doing. So it was easy enough where I could kind of approach it, kind of unsure what I was doing, but still win without having to, like, reset. But anyways, I actually went back and looked up, like, last year. So this System Shock came out in 2023, the remake. Last year, it came out for consoles. It came out for consoles later. And at that time, that's when they also updated it, kind of a all-in-one sort of deal. And I was actually going through the patch notes that they had last year. And there's a bunch, like a bunch of just small little, like, behaviors and progression blockers and glitches that are fixed and things like that. It's like, oh, okay. So this a year after launch, they did tune up a bunch of stuff and they added a bunch of stuff. And just for fun, like, I actually did play as the female hacker that they added. Doesn't do anything. It's just, you know, kind of an aesthetic, but that was something they added that wasn't in the original. So,
yeah.
The hacker is the main character, by the way.
Was there any voice acting in the remake?
Besides your character kind of making grunt sounds when you jump and dash and stuff? No. I mean, well, there's voice acting. Sorry. There's voice acting from the, like, Shodan and, like, the audio logs you get, but your main character doesn't talk.
Okay. All right.
Okay, with the Rise of the Ronin interview and Adam's experience revisiting, or not revisiting, but going back to 2023's remake of System Shock, we'll head into the new section of this podcast. So not a ton this week, but I did put up something here that was that I thought seemed like the most interesting out of the headlines. This is a big, I don't know, undertaking by Kite, who translates a lot of Japanese press for us. This is from Nipponichi Software. They had a streaming event called Untitled, which I am not familiar with, but I guess it's a semi-regular, you know, direct style podcast where they talk about upcoming, you know, things they're working on, what their teams are doing.
It's definitely not something they've ever done. There's, like, kind of the first time they've done this.
Okay. I was like, I'm not familiar with this, but it doesn't mean it hasn't been around a long time. But okay, so this is a new initiative for them. So they basically touched on six titles that are in development that are slated to release. I think all six are either, like, this year or next year, like, in mid-development, and some of them are slated to come out this year. So the way that Kite kind of framed this, and we have this up on our produce site, all of the translated work and the bulleted, like, details about what they talked about. Kite kind of picked out three that fit kind of our site scope, you know, RPG, RPG adjacent titles, or titles that we've kind of covered games from that same pedigree in the past. And I'll talk more about what I mean by that in a moment, as well as the other titles that they talked about. Because, you know, Nipponichi, they have a wide breadth of genres and game types that they publish and develop. So just kind of go through the list here. The first one that they talked about, I don't know, I shouldn't say the first one. The first one that we have listed, a game called Curse, which is a dungeon crawling RPG. And it seems like it's basically, it's hard to talk about, like, what this sets itself aside from, like, Etrian Odyssey or Grimrock or, you know, those other sorts of first-person dungeon crawlers. The only media here is, like, some concept art for this, but the game is slated to release on all consoles, not all consoles, PS4, PS5, and Switch this year. My understanding about the way that Kite has summarized this, it's a 2-hour streaming event, and I have not watched the VOD, is that it seems like it has, like, a attrition mechanics where your player can get cursed, and how you deal with those curses during the time of your, you know, your dungeon diving, and how you, like, counteract those, or your countermeasures they have against those. So long-term debuffs that you can kind of inflict upon yourself to potentially, like, improve your reward or your output of something in some way.
So they're basically describing this game, and this is, like, all only for Japan so far. They haven't really, obviously, Nisa right. hasn't commented on any of these, so this is all just for Japan so far. Probably a good chunk of them will get localized, but not all of them. But, like, the way that they described it is that it's like a dark dungeon RPG And there's a variety of like classes. They revealed like, you know, standard ones like fighter, barbarian, sorcerer, paladin, archer. There's gonna be more classes. And like you go dungeon dive into like these dungeons and you accrue curses that you said, of course, will debuff your party. But you can actually go back to the surface and like when you purify those curses, you'll actually get like bonus buffs or stats. Or like things that you can turn those purified curses into like something that strengthens you. So you're intentionally debuffing or collecting these curses to dive back out and purify them to become stronger, which is an interesting concept, like risk versus rewards. How much do I want to like, you know, risk this run to potentially get like something like a big reward if I'm able to make it out? I like you said, like a lot of these, they didn't show like any like concrete like in-game like video or screenshots. Is a lot of concept art because a lot of these are like are deep in development. They're not ready to show anything publicly right now. It's kind of an interesting of how they did this because this reminds me of like what Idea Factory did several months ago when leadership changed over there. So they actually gave us like a roadmap of like all the different projects that they're working on. Not to say that like leadership has like fundamentally shifted at Nippon Ichi Software. But like it's similar to like when Marvel is announcing their next phase of like films, so they like lay out like a roadmap. Like here are the films that we're gonna be tackling over the next few years. Very similar to what Idea Factory and Nisa are doing here. Like here's a roadmap of all like not all, but like very much a good chunk of what we're working on. So there's not like any like crazy left field surprises. Like oh, it's cool. Like Nisa's like in a healthy spot. Like they're tackling on. Not just like they're tackling on a lot of new IPs. I mean, we stress this a lot about Nice development, where they're like one of the most prominent Japanese developers that like consistently tackles new IPs. They don't really lean heavily on like sequels, like say like Capcom does, for example. So it's always cool to see. I want to root for them, but obviously, you know, not because of the risk of developing new IPs. Not all of them are always going to be hits. Some of them are going to be more experimental. Some of them may not like land, you know, et cetera. So, yeah, it is
kind of a breath of fresh air just to be like, yeah, we have these studios that we're partnered with, and these are the projects they're working on, and here is unglamorous, like in process work we're doing, like yeah, very cool. Candid and very kind of open. Yeah. It's not as like bombastic as like here's a vertical slice trailer from a game we've been working on for 8 years, sort of thing. But I kind of like it all the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very fascinating to catch like the tail end of the stream and see a bunch of these games. I'm interested in some of them. It's very, very funny, though, how Renzu is just straight up. They just stole like Spirit Hunter. That's just Spirit Hunter.
Yeah. So, yeah, we talked about Curse. Yeah, the second one, Renzu. Kite had a summary here. A horror visual novel slated for release on. Yeah, in summer 2025, so only a few months away.
Yeah, that's PS5, PS4, Switch in Japan. You know, not an RPG, but like as James said, it's very much like in that Spirit Hunter vein, where like you know, it's very centered around curses, centered around like the you know, your protagonist is this journalist reporter for the cult magazine, and exploring you know the urban legends and rumors. And whatnot, which is, you know, not too far away from the Spirit Hunter premise.
Yeah, not too far away from Deathmark. It's very... And then you look at, like, the small glimpse of gameplay we got, and it's like, that's just Spirit Hunter. That's just Spirit... You just stole Spirit Hunter.
Yeah, so we'll see what their spin on it is, but it's cool what they've shown nonetheless, so we'll see how they handle that. The next RPG that Kite didn't list as Renzu's RPG, but the next one he listed after Curse was Kyoran, codenamed Kyoran, which is, he says, is Kite's translation for that is Misfortunate Chaos. He describes that as an action RPG coming to PS5 and Switch, slated for next year in Japan. Kite mentions that this is the one that has the most profound relation to the Disgaea series, which, you know, Disgaea is the moneymaker for Nice. It includes the character designer Takehito Harada, and Tenpei Sato as the composer. Shunsei Minoa, also worked on Disgaea 7, is in charge of the game's development team. And, you know, Kite goes on to mention how there's other, like, gameplay systems in Kyoran that is very reminiscent of this guy, especially, like, the inflated stat values that they're posturing for this upcoming action RPG. So we'll see how that goes. They released, like, some concept art of, like, the main character, which is definitely looks like someone out of this guy.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I don't want to be like, oh, they all, you know, we talked about this with
he looks like a handsome Squidward version of the Disgaea 5 protagonist.
That's definitely a way to describe it, yes. But yeah, but it's definitely emblematic of Harada style for sure. You can definitely see the Harada, you know, the Disgaea lineage is definitely flowing in the visual style of this game, based on like the concept art that they showed so far. So we'll see how this, you know, it's still far off, still sometime next year. See how that works out. People who are fans of like the, what do you call this series, like the Liar Prince, the Blind Prince, and the Firefly Diary, I forget if they have the Gobble is the one I'm talking about. Side-scrolling action game. This was conceived by an employee in their second year at
NEES. Oh, right, yeah, that one, yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's like born from like a competition at the Nippon Ichi Project Festival. This follows a similar lineage to like other titles like Yomawari and Liar Princess and the Blind Prince, who came out of that Nippon Ichi Project Festival, like sort of the creation of those titles, getting them greenlighted, and this is about a protagonist who encounters a talking sickle during a sudden monster attack. The Nippon Ichi has said like the key mechanic in this game is consuming defeated enemies through predation. So, and the sickle can steal like the enemies that it consumes. So it's sort of like
Mighty sort of like Number 9.
I don't know. I wouldn't say that. It's not like Mighty Number 9 is like the only game that's done like sort of like, hey, your weapon powers up by defeating enemies and feeding on them. Like I think of like Shinobi on PS2, for example. And the style of the game that they have shown through that stream is like sort of like American comic style events. And you see some illustrations on Gamatsu's article right up. So. I didn't mean to throw you off on that because I got thrown off by the way.
It's natural when we're talking about an event that talked about six games and we're kind of assigning arbitrary preference ordering to them based on genre, even though genres are pretty loose, you know.
Looking at the actual screenshots from the live stream on the Gamatsu article, I was completely right. Yeah, Renzu just straight up is like legitimately a Deathmark clone. It's even got the grid. Oh my god, what are you guys doing over there?
So as James was mentioning earlier, the third RPG that Kite listed as part of like the RPG titles that that they mentioned on the live stream is Shinigami Hime, and this is like the third installment following the Liar Princess and the Blind Prince and the Cruel King and the Great Hero games. This is like the next like installment of those. This comes from Sayaka Oda as a character designer returning from those games, and then planning scenario is Kento Jobana, who did Barstella Abyss and Process Nation.
Jobana also did Disgaea 7 and Phantom Brave the Lost Hero.
Okay, nice. So, and then like the prior titles, this stars like the main two characters are a monster and a human. And then this title focuses on young girls suffering from trauma whose altered picture book worlds are housed within a strange library. So, players in this upcoming title coming in 2026 in Japan, we'll see how when it comes to the West. Players are collecting memory fragments scattered throughout a picture book. So people who like those previous titles with Liar Princess and the Cruel King, this upcoming game is definitely within that emblematic style. You know, that obviously didn't have any like footage to show off, just some concept art. So that's cool to see that, like, you know, that series of games is still alive and healthy and getting more support in the future. Other than that, there's other ones that unfortunately will never get localized unless a fan translation comes out, because they Nice announced a new installment to the Furaiki series, and the Furaiki games are motorcycle travel based visual novel, and the series is very, very popular in Japan because that people really like the way that it depicts real life locations in Japan, and generally like the writing and the characters, the routes, the different girls that you meet in these games. I know people who've acquaintances that played through these games and can't praise them enough. So they announced Furaiki 5, which is interesting because they were very iffy on like whether the Furaiki series was going to continue, because it seems like they disbanded like that development team after Furaiki 4, but it seems like, you know, some of the key staff are coming back, but I don't know what the actual staff of the Furaiki 5 is composed of. And they're also releasing the first Furaiki game onto Steam, but only in Japan, or only supporting Japanese text as well. So, you know, it's one of those games that like I wish would get localized, but I don't know how well. It's probably not commercially viable in the West, unfortunately, because it's very much for a very niche audience, and I don't think I can't imagine it's worth it.
It's also really striking that pretty much nothing besides that, like port of the original Furaiki, nothing that they announced is coming out on PC.
Yeah.
Even though it's like we've had devs, we were talking about the Rise of the Ronin interview earlier, where like Koei Tecmo themselves said, "Yeah, no, PC player base in Japan is a big deal now," and it's like,
yeah,
it feels like the type of games that. NAS releases would have an audience on PC, but they just...
I wonder if it's like one of those things that's like they release the console versions first, and there's just some process, internal process, like the PC will come later when it gets localized into the web.
The problem is, though, is that like NIS like America, they like I've had like employees at NIS America kind of complain about the fact that it makes their lives more difficult when there's not already a PC version, because, like, obviously, for them, they need to release stuff on PC.
Yeah, I can believe that for sure. So, yeah, I really wonder if there's just, like, some sort of, like, the way they... I can't comment. I don't work for them. I don't know what the internal process is like, but I just wonder if, like, there's just, like, some stipulation between the main Japanese branch and the Western branch is saying, hey, these will come to PC when, like, you know, it's when the global version is releasing. So obviously that makes life harder for, you know, someone in the ranks to be like, okay, well, we have to build a PC port from the ground up then for global release, which is frustrating, but.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summary of all the things that I almost said Nice America. NIS, like Josh said, this is only from the Japanese side right now. Upcoming projects slated to release in Japan this year and next. A few that are RPG, several that are RPG adjacent. A few other trailers that released this week. The one that I put as, you know, the biggest one is actually probably the least important as a trailer, but probably has the most discussion behind it. This is for the upcoming worldwide release for Trails in the Sky, first chapter, I guess. Is it the first in Japan and first chapter in the West?
Yeah.
So this is for the complete, you know, remake of the first entry of the Kiseki, you know, Legend of Heroes Trail series. And this is all about voice cast. So it's a short trailer that doesn't actually have any voiceover, but it goes through the VAs and comparably.
I have to say, it is a bummer that they do this where you have a voice cast trailer, but you don't get to hear any samples of the voices.
None of the voices, yeah.
No, there is one little sample. In the second short trailer, there's like Legend of Heroes, or they set the...
Great.
Right.
Thanks, Chao. Yes, a very small sample of one character saying the title. Great.
Yes.
So the interesting thing here is that in English, I think they got, is it everyone back or most people back?
Most people back, yeah.
Which one, what's the exception, do we know?
You don't get the same Zin voice. You get the new one, which is, I think it's a downgrade.
Zin's been voiced in, like,
yeah.
Well, also, I think, like, the original, like, Olivier was Troy Baker.
Oh, really?
And, now it's Matt Mercer. And he was replaced by Matt Mercer later, and now Matt Mercer's the voice.
Yeah, so, but it's weird, because, well, weird's not the right word, but obviously, originally, they just had a few Battle voice works, lines.
Right.
That, yeah, effectively. But they had a, you know, at the time, you know, 2000, what was it, 7, 6? Because it was 2004 in Japan, and then a few years later for the PSP version in the West. Where they got, like, Stephanie Shea and Johnny Young Bosch, which are not huge names now, but were bigger names at the time, to do the Battle Barks. And they still are the voice cast for Josh and Estelle. And they got, you know, Gung Ho, obviously a different publisher from both Exceed or NIS America, but they got the voice cast back, which is, and that's in the middle of a SAG-AFTRA strike too, which obviously I don't keep tabs on who's in, you know, which of these voice actors are based in Texas, which are based in LA, things like that. But then on the Japanese side, which I can't speak to other than the lead here, most of the cast is actually different, which is a bit unusual for Japanese.
Yeah, I only got two returning ones.
Yeah, the thing that gets me is that, like, Charizard is not returning, which tells me we are never seeing her in a mainline Trails game ever again. Like, going forward.
I think so.
Because, like, one of my main complaints with Reverie was how they kind of, like, the weird way they treated Shara. Like, basically, like, at least in the Japanese version, like, only really referring to her as Olivier's wife.
I can see that. Yeah.
So it's like, now I'm like, oh, man. Does this voice cast change mean that she's just never going to show up as a playable character again? Because that's the read I'm getting, and that doesn't feel good.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, speculation's obviously not known for sure, but I do kind of share your opinion about how they, you know, brought her back in Reverie, but in that context.
So yeah, so for people who don't know, like, the only returning Japanese seiyuu for the Trails of the Sky first chapter remake is Olivier's, which is Koyasu, Takehito Koyasu, very, very iconic voice. Most people will recognize him as Dio from the JoJo anime.
And he also voiced one of the villains in Atelier Yumiya. Like, we have to talk too much about
Koyasu has voiced fucking everything. Koyasu is so great. He is an eternal force of energy in Japan for many years. And Zin's seiyuu is the same as Tetsu Inada. Once again, also a very, very popular seiyuu over there. Aside from them, everyone else has changed. And, you know, some of them are a lot of new blood, like, you know, Gera's Rizal's Chika Anzai, very, very, you know, prominent seiyuu.
I love her. I think she's, like, one of the best, but, like, when she first started, everyone's kind of comparing her to, like, Hanakana, saying, oh, she sounds just like her, it's, like, a cheaper, but she kind of stand out on her own, and probably superior, like, if you see, like, the new ReZero season.
Yeah, so people will, you know, in anime will know her as Chisato from Licorice Recoil, one of the main characters there. Chisei from Gridman, also a popular main character from there. She's just had a lot of anime roles, just a very, very, very talented seiyuu. The one that caught my eye was Hina Yomiya for Chloe.
Yeah, you know what? If you ever heard her voice, I feel like she sounds exactly like Reina Ueda. I cannot tell the two apart. So.
For me, it's just like I'm on my Maigo and Avenbujica arc right now, so her being Tomori from Maigo is like, oh my god, you know. But obviously she's done many other roles besides that, up and coming talent, but it's just like
I get why they're being replaced, in my opinion. I feel like if they're gonna, like, remake, like, all the games and all, like, the current voice actors and actresses are probably in their 40s to 60s, it's like,
yeah, for me it's not if they're gonna do this whole remake some other games, they need, like, you know, characters that, like, you know, can still are still active in the industry, right? And a lot of the older seiyuu, you know, are up there in years. It's gonna be hard to reproduce you know, their iconic lines if they're getting up there in years. So I understand that, like, the even stuff like there's been voice actor changes for doing like the JoJo fighting game, that from CyberConnect 2 and the JoJo anime series, you know. And it's because some of those talents, you know, probably like didn't fit their character, and they plan to support the anime for many, many, many years. So they need to have those characters, you know, be at events, be active, you know. And this would be the perfect time to get a new voice cast if they're just like remaking it. So I understand, you know, why.
I even hear like the Japanese cast are pretty disappointed, like, because they're still kind of active, like for Stella and Joshua's like voice actors. They're like, mm-hmm. I see. I guess I wasn't part of it. That's a bit sad.
I mean, you know? Yeah. Obviously, it sucks, you know, for people who like got used to those voices or are very big fans of them. This would be the time to do it, if they're gonna do it. And it's understandable. I'm like left in the decision. Like, do I do the English cast or the Japanese cast for my
play? Play with the Japanese cast. I don't really care about the English cast on the first one, because they only do battle lines. You really don't really know much of what they do.
They're gonna be fully voiced now, so I mean,
I know it's like, and when you play Cold Steel 4, they come in as appearance. It feels like they're just reading a script because they don't know anything about these characters after coming back like 20 years. That's how I feel, right? Mm. It feels like they're just talking a bunch of random like mumbo jumbo, right? Mm. At least that's how my take about it, right?
That's fine. Yeah. So yeah, I might do Japanese voice cast because I'm really interested to see like how this new cast fits in with their characters, how accustomed they are.
Like, they've been slowly transitioning to like different voices, like in the Cold Steel games. Like when Ren returned, it's like she got replaced by Aoyuki for example, right? So they've been slowly trying to shift like newer casts.
That's going to be an interesting one when they remake second chapter. Assuming they remake second chapter, you know, that's when Ren gets introduced along with a whole bunch of other characters. See if there's any big like voice cast changes over there.
I'm sure they're going to keep the current one, which is Aoyuki.
I mean, they're definitely going to keep Aoyuki for Ren for sure, 10,000%. They're not going to replace her.
I'm so glad that I got a new voice for Tita. I do not like her OG Japanese voice at one bit. I feel she is miscast in everything, and I absolutely despise.
Yeah, she does kind of sound off.
I don't think it's possible to be miscast in everything. Like,
yeah,
miscast in everything is kind of an oxymoron. That means they just are bad. I don't even
know. I don't know. I see her like every anime, and I would dislike this character from the get-go.
I can think of a few English voices like that, like Gilbert Gottfried, if he was voiced. Like, oh, he's miscast. But then again, no, he's perfect for Yago. So there you go. Never mind. I take it back.
For who? Oh.
I'm talking about like Disney animation at this point. Okay. I'm a tangent. My bad.
But usually a miscast is like a great actor just in the wrong role. But if you're wrong in every role, then are you a great actor anymore?
I'll be honest. I think Johnny Young Bosch is a little bit of a miscast for Joshua. Like, I think his voice is almost like too deep, but I guess
I think Johnny Young Bosch is actually better as like an anti-hero or villain, personally.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, like even the new DMC anime coming on Netflix, like JYOB is doing Dante's voice in that, and like it's hard for me to get used to his voice because I feel like it's a mismatch. But maybe it's good. I don't know. But whenever I hear the trailers, I'm like, I can't get used to it. I don't know. JYOB is cool though. He is cool.
Yeah, no, he's a good dude, and he's done a lot of, you know, he's done a lot of roles where he's perfectly cast. So,
yeah, I don't hate him. I don't think anybody. I would say I dislike the Tito's Japanese voice, and that includes a lot of other shows I watched when she starred.
I feel the same for Papenbrook.
So hopefully, you know, they eventually release a trailer for both of these that actually have like, you know, voice lines that we can hear. Them, that'd be great. Instead of like, we're announcing it, do we have samples? No, we're just announcing the names. Great, awesome. But it was enough to get a lot of talk, obviously, especially the Japanese side, with the big recast throughout the, and it's just for the main cast. It's not even talking about the secondary cast as well, which obviously all of these games have big secondary casts, so I'm interested to see, like, you know, who else got recasted aside from the main cast in these games.
Who voices Anton?
Who voices Respin?
Mm-hmm. Who voices the photography, the Dorothy?
They had to replace Neil because his Japanese voice died.
Well, actually, Richard, does he have an English voice in like any other media?
I don't know. Because
he's not shown up again.
Oh, wait. He's playable in the fur. And did they dub the fur? I don't remember.
Well, so there'd be battle barks. So yeah, who did Richard's battle barks in the third? I don't know, because he's a good character that I'm surprised we haven't seen more of.
Who does those three? I haven't played some of the later games, so maybe these characters showed up. But the three like blue haired bandit people.
Capua family.
Yeah, like, just a little. Who plays that? Who voices them?
Yeah. So a lot of questions that need answers that we'll find out when Tales of the Sky first chapter releases. This fall.
I'm also curious, how much are they gonna voice? Are they gonna, redub the entire main story just like the Evil games? Or are they just gonna, voice, a couple of voice bits because they don't have the budget? Because you're like Daybreak, where everyone just talks, a few lines, and they're silent again. It's like, oh, they ran out of money again.
The weird thing about Daybreak and Daybreak 2 is, you'll have the whole cast, and I know we're not talking about those games, but I'm curious what tack they'll take for the first chapter. You have the whole cast speaking with no voiceover, but then a new character will enter the scene and their lines will be voiced. Interspersed between the cast is not like there's Daybreak 2, the Arkwright Solutions team is talking with no voice, and Shizune shows up and she's voiced, and then the rest of the team is not voiced, but she's still voiced, and it's very strange.
East 10 had a little bit of
that. That's just one example. Yeah, East does that as well. That's one thing that I think that Exceed for Cold Steel 1 and 2 really tried their damnedest to try to get the extra voice lines in for the English to try to prevent a little bit of that to their credit at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we'll see. It'd be interesting to see what first chapter does.
Who voices Chloe's classmates at the academy?
That's true.
I forget their names.
Real.
One of them's really annoying.
Whoever gets a face portrait will get the voice. That's how it goes.
That's a lot of voices then. There's a lot of face portraits in these earlier games. So yeah, we'll see. Every little tidbit of new info for these games is it really makes you wonder what they're gonna do.
I kind of have three bang, bang, bang news stories here. We don't really talk about these too much on the podcast because there's not a whole lot of meat on this bone, but two games that released early this year have already gotten some significant patches. Avowed patch basically had a big overhaul in terms of not only just quest progression and things like that, but I saw a lot of people really thinking that the perk points that you get when you level up in Avowed were very stingy, which means you really had to specialize. And what you were doing, you couldn't really hybrid class, between the different trait lines, as well as people feeling like they had super limited resources available to upgrade weapons and things. Well, the last two patches for Avowed, I guess 1.2 and 1.3, really kind of targeted those. I logged back into my file, and even retroactively, it was you got 5 more perk points. Go ahead and use them. Oh, neat. So just trying to smooth out the I don't know if the leveling curve is quite the right term, but the progression in that game, so you don't feel so hamstrung in terms of what you're allowed to do, give you a little bit more flexibility. Damn, so I think that's a smart adjustment there. Go ahead.
I feel like I should have played it earlier then, because the way people were talking about it at launch, it's like, oh, that's what I'm in for. I kind of want something like that. Now it sounds like they're sanding down the edges a bit.
So we didn't play the real game, James. We got it. We got in too late. We can't call ourselves avowed gamers whenever we play now, because we get the casual experience.
Well, that's the sort of thing where you can always choose just not to spend your 5 extra skill points or whatever. But I do get where you're coming from in terms of here's multiple skill trees, but you can just really go ham on all of them. You don't really have to specialize. I don't think they went that far. I don't think they rounded it down too much. But I had no issues with the original experience, but I was playing it pretty thoroughly. So I was exploring the whole map and things like that. Another early game that I definitely want to come to is Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. Adam and I are actually in Discord last night, and he's like, why does Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 have a 70 gig update? I guess this is patch 1.2. The big things here are modding support, so official mod support, which I don't really know of. I played the first game without really any mods. I have no idea what the modding scene there was, but Warhorse is really trying to come out the gate. Well, not at the gate, but close to it, with Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 having official mod support. So that was introduced, as well as barber options, which, of course, that's the second highest feature on everyone's list, is making Henry look as dapper as you want.
He's already well perfect.
As well as a bunch of other fixes. So I guess they call this the first of several free DLC. So I guess this was already on the roadmap. And I'm sure it was, but I forgot. They have a cadence of free updates coming, as well as the paid updates. And one of the free updates was, barber support, modding support. and here it is.
Yeah, I appreciate so also now, like the transparency behind them, like even just like very finely detailed things, like they refined Chinese translations for both traditional and simplified, improved Korean font, which is like, I don't think I've ever read that out of a press. It's like, okay, that's cool that like they improved the Korean font. I guess it was hard to read. And a newly recorded French voiceover. And I'm like, man, did they really botch the French voiceover? It's like one of those things like you would never think about, but it's like you read it, it's like, huh, I never knew that the they were having problems with the other localization, you know, scripts for the game.
Well, in the original Kingdom Come Deliverance, they didn't have Czech voiceover at first, and then they added it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, it's made by Czech people, so.
Mm-hmm.
It really does just kind of nail down that so many games these days really are global products.
Yeah.
If saying a game is from Japan or from Poland or from the US, kind of means less and less for not all games, but several games these days. And then the last one here, this is just kind of a footnote here. Pixel Remasters, which of course came out a while ago at this point. If you remember, draw your head back, you know, 3-4 years, mid-pandemic. I remember when those released and everyone was like, the font is terrible. Like, you had to do these weird system workarounds or mods to get the font to look something more like what you remember.
And you had the waterfall of like alternate fonts. It's like, since people found out, it's like, it's relatively easy once you know. So people have like released like a mountain of like alternate like fonts you can use instead of like the shitty one that they launched with. You know, that was a fun era.
Yeah, and so what this is an update to the mobile versions of them. Have updated them with what they call the classic font. Now, I have not like looked at iOS store reviews to see like how faithful it is, but here we are 4 years later, they've updated the font of the mobile versions of these games, as well as updates for BGM options as well. So you can choose the Pixel Remaster arrangements or the original, which seems like something that should have been there, but better late than never. But then of course begs the question, which I know I'm not using that idiom properly, but begs the question, when is this going to show up on the, you know, the other versions of the game, the console versions or the PC version? And we don't know, but they came out to the mobile version. So hopefully the PC versions the other version won't be far behind. So, well, better late than never, I suppose. Good to have for those games to have just, hey, I want to have the font that I knew from when I played these games, you know.
And this is like coming hot off the heels. I think we discussed this on the last podcast where they had like, you know, released a new update for the PC version that had some of these, but not all of these, like the you were mentioning. Yeah. So it's kind of like these stealth updates to both the PC version and the mobile version, but the mobile version got some stuff and the PC version got some stuff, but not all in between. It's not like parody in between these. Both of them are like sort of similar in the bug fixes of the game, but not like the BGM source obviously didn't come to like the
PC version. What I always go back to is when Final Fantasy XII, the Zodiac Age, was coming out. Every single version of that added something. So it was like, I forget the order. Maybe Adam remembers.
It was PlayStation first. And then I think they did the PC port after that. And then they did like the Switch and Xbox ports after that. And yes, they kept adding stuff. They eventually backported all the changes, but it took them years to do that.
Yeah, it was like, this version has New Game Plus, but not New Game Minus. This one has the dark demon mode or whatever it was. This one doesn't. This one has this thing, or you can play it on, you know, NG mode. But it was so weird, like keeping track of all that. Like, why can't you just do this all at once? Come on. And now they're doing not as bad, but similar things.
Yeah, so come back here in 5 years and maybe we'll be at a state where all the versions of the game have all of the things.
And we don't have a news story on this, but we're talking about Square Enix. Obviously, we're at the 30th anniversary of Chrono Trigger. And there was a statement, and maybe, I don't know if someone has more context than I did, that basically they have like several projects in the works, like a very kind of broad feel-good statement.
I believe that it was like the thing was like non-game projects. It was like further extended merchandising or marketing.
That's what I was thinking. Like,
but it's like beyond the game world. So it's not like, they're not saying that like they're making a sequel to Chrono Trigger or something. Like, it's like, hey, we're going to have like
new Chrono Trigger will never get a sequel.
I kind of expected that, like, projects in the works, like we're gonna have an arrangement album or something. I have no idea.
They have like a music stream for it, like, you know, so
We're gonna release the soundtrack on Spotify, things like that. And you know, of course, people see the headline and like immediately are like, oh, finally, Chrono Break or whatever. It's like, hold your horses. Like,
it's no. Never coming, guys. Sorry.
Chrono Cross Definitive Edition.
Oh god, go. Please, obviously, no.
Well, we kind of already had that sort of.
No, I mean they're remaking Chrono Cross to the in a matter the Chrono Trigger fans will love instead.
Okay. But yeah, obviously we'll report here if anything does come out of that. But yeah, Chrono Trigger is a great game, and it's 30 years old now. You're welcome.
Great.
All right. Other trailers. These ones are a little bit more minor. Clair Obscur Expedition 33, of course, is releasing at the end of next month. Sounds like they're going on a media, you know, blitz of different character trailers, starting out, of course, with Gustav. But and like. The trailer doesn't go into like, here's how you play as him, here's his unique mechanic, but it does show a little bit of it. But if you haven't like read and followed all the previews to really see how his overcharge works, the trailer doesn't really detail it enough on its own. You kind of have to read other stuff to see it. So it's really more for the flavor of the character than anything else. So we'll probably see some for the other characters as we go closer to launch. Here's another one. These ones are kind of releasing without a lot of fanfare. We're finally getting the DLCs for Aiden Chronicle 100 Heroes. Last month we had the one for Marissa, and this month we're getting the Chapter of Sign. Each of these is getting like a little 1 minute trailer for them. The only thing I've heard is that we had someone in our Discord say that they played the Chapter of Marissa and it wasn't very good. So I'm interested, but not excited.
I will play these DLCs, but I have like zero expectations at all. Actually, I pretty much have like negative expectations. These are gonna suck. I hope for the next game, which I assume it sounded like they were gonna do a sequel. It sounded like they were planning on it. I hope it doesn't do Kickstarter, and if I hope they do some sort of crowdfunding, like. Just don't promise like expansions, because then you just get stuff like this where it's just kind of like we promised it, so we have to deliver, even if it probably would have been best without it.
I think they start to learn. I mean, come on. Have anyone remember the Mighty Number 9? How they offer like 10 different ports? Only two, okay.
This is the second time Mighty Number 9's been
mentioned.
Referred to in this podcast, and I don't like it. It's distressing me.
Like, who are you going to go on your prom date?
I just think sometimes with Kickstarter games, you run into this problem where they want to make a stretch goal because they're trying to get funding. Like, everyone give us money so we can hit this goal, you know? And obviously I get why they do it, but then it's like, oh, now we actually have to do it. And sometimes it just doesn't, it's not worth it.
Now you're making me want to check what the status is on that dual Kickstarter with the Wild Arms.
Oh, they actually just had an update.
There's a news that came out recently.
They just had an update. They just sent out an update for the dual Kickstarter. They basically said our original Kickstarter had a March 2025 date. That's not going to happen, which honestly, that's not a surprise at all. Kickstarters almost never hit their like target dates. They actually shared a screenshot of the menu of Arm Fantasia. Like, it's an in-progress menu. Let me share it here.
That's the Wild Hearts one. The
Wild Hearts one seems like it's in an okay spot. The Wild Hearts. Wild Hearts? What the heck? Wild Arms. That one seems like it's in an okay spot. It's the other one, Penny Blood, that is like, is this even going to happen? I don't know.
They're still looking for a publisher, right?
I played Penny Blood Hellbound. It's, I would say it's a bad game. It's okay. Maybe not broken, but it's like not a very good game. And right now the Penny Blood Hellbound like team is like they're making like Amazon Kindle short stories. Like, this is where we're at.
No way.
Yeah. Anyways, the Wild Arms successor seems like it'll actually exist at one point. One second, let me see if I can get this.
Yeah, because you're a backer, so you have the
I get the updates.
The updates, yeah. I forgot I tried to find the Kickstarter picture. Arm Fantasia. Kickstarter. I think that's the Google
way. My computer's acting up here, but here we go.
Yeah. Okay. Cause, yeah, it's called Double Kickstarter, not Dual Kickstarter for Jared.
Yeah. So there's we actually have like a menu screenshot of Arm Fantasia. It's obviously like in progress, but it actually feels like they've shown screenshots of some of the characters. They've shown screenshots of the menu, and it seems like, hey, there's actually a game in development here. So.
Okay.
By the way, 0% of the Steam reviews for Chapter of Marissa are positive.
Jeez.
There's only 11.
Great.
But the 11 people who went out of their way to play it were like, nope.
Well, or leave a review, rather.
Right.
One person said, 5 chests, 1 mini boss, 1 boss, 1 dungeon. It's basically just a bonus. It's a side quest.
And how expensive is it? Like $8 or something like that?
It is $8.
Jesus, like
that's a lot.
I remember seeing that. I'm like, that seems really expensive.
I got Kingdom Come Deliverance 1 for like $8. Years after the fact, admittedly, but all right, what else? Fuga Melodies of Steel. Fuga Melodies of Steel 3 got a trailer talking about its battle system as well as its endings, like secret endings or character endings. And maybe I'll let James speak to this, because I saw you used to say something on Blue Sky about what you were trying to glean about what they were showing in terms of like number of endings or something.
Well,
like that.
As part of the they did send out a PR blast, part of the things they said is we knew that Fuga 3 was going to have branching paths in the narrative to some extent, but we didn't know exactly what that meant for things. Now we know is that there's 8 endings. There's 5 bad endings. There's a normal ending, a true ending, and then a special ending you get for getting all the other endings. So it seems like that it's kind of similar to the way they're saying it. It sounds like even though they say there's a true ending and a special ending, the real thing is that there's a normal ending, a good ending, and then a true ending. That's the vibe I'm getting. But I think this is good because one of the main problems that I think Fuga 2 had is that it was too derivative. The fact that we've already seen a bunch of stuff like here's how you can upgrade the Tyrannus. Here's a, you can have totally different routes. You have like a bunch of different like small features that add up. It's like this seems like it's going to be a way more fully featured game. Whereas like I enjoyed Fuga 1 and 2, but part of the reason I did enjoy it was at the time it was a very like streamlined and focused experience and was like tightly designed. But I felt like, and I even said this at the time, I felt like if 3 was of the same vein, it was going to get old really quickly because 2 was already basically just a Master Quest version of Fuga 1, for lack of a better term. So
yeah, I think Fuga 2 is undoubtedly a better game than Fuga 1, but it's so iterative.
Yeah, it's like I just on the spot came up with it feels like a Master Quest version of Fuga 1. It's like not the more I think about it, that really does feel like a pretty apt comparison. But yeah, I'm excited for 3. Hopefully the extra scope doesn't bloat it out because that's absolutely going to be a concern of mine. But you know what?
their next update, it's like it's an open world now.
But anyways, if nothing else, the soundtrack is going to be incredible. The gameplay itself should still be awesome, because that's like one thing Fuga 1 and 2 were really great about, was the battle system was very satisfying. So I'm excited.
And that's coming out on May 29th.
Yep.
This one I should have brought up when we were talking about Square Enix and Pixel Remasters. They've also sold over 5 million copies across all platforms.
Pixel Remasters, that's a good amount. Good. And then the FF series, collectively, all of the Final Fantasy series has now sold over 200 million copies.
Which, to me, I look at that and I can't like contextualize it because that's a lot of games, spin-offs and, you know, mobile games and card games and digital card games, like weird stuff. Chocobo Racing, is that included? I don't know. Things like that. Like, yeah, 200, yeah, it's a big number for a big number. Yeah, big number for a big number of games. But obviously,
but you can be cynical about like, well, you know, GTA 5 sold like a gajillion copies. Yeah. More. It's like, thanks.
Yeah, GTA 5 sold 50 million copies on its own. Step it up, Square Enix. And then in terms of release dates, I think I only found one that was new. Through G-Mode, which I forget what that is. Adam, can you help me out here? Glory of Heracles 3 will be ported to PC. And that's like a feature phone game. Like that, we talked about that Aegis feature phone game that came out around the same time as Persona 3. getting ported to PC through a similar means. Yeah. So that's kind of how I contextualize this. Like one of those 2000 pre-iPhone era of games that would never leave Japan because our phones were so different and behind.
Yeah, Dreamo is basically like, you know, they're doing that initiative that you're saying of like, hey, there's like these flip phone games that were exclusive to flip phones at the time, and they don't have like any release on any modern platforms, even modern mobile platforms. Mm-hmm. They're doing this initiative like, hey, we want to, for game preservation purposes, they want to put these on a modern platform like Steam. Like, you know, they also had like previously, like they might have also like showed up like at the Wii Shop, for example, or like the Nintendo eShop, like, but they still had like classic releases going for that for those storefronts. And you also see some of it on Switch as well, but I think that's through another company that does like PC Engine. So, you know, it's cool to see that, like, you know, they're continuing to do this, even though it doesn't have like, some of these may not have like official English localizations. You know, that stuff can be ironed out for the future as long as they have like something set in stone, at least. In a forward-moving platform, like, you know, that will be preserved perpetuity.
And then Kite did throw in a piece of trivia here for Glory of Heracles 3. I guess one of the scenario writers for this game was Kazushige Nojima, you know, of Square Enix fame.
There you go.
Who did
Raynaudis.
Most of, yeah, also that.
A Raynaudis fame.
And that covers us for the news topics that I had queued up for this episode of the TetraCast. So thank you for welcoming me back and having me have a chance to talk a little bit about the games that I played while I was out, and then talking about Atelier Yumiya, a little bit of Rise of the Ronin, of course, which is now available on PC, and looking forward to things like Clair-Obscur Expedition 33 and Trails in the Sky, first chapter.
Next week we'll have Xenoblade X, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, right?
Is that next week?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. So we'll have a handful of people here that can talk to that, both in terms of original game and remake. Of course, we kind of had a prelude to that a few weeks ago when Adam talked about his and Cullen's little primer document. Mm-hmm. So it'll be able to kind of dovetail or, you know, bookend the other side of that conversation there. Maybe touch on a little bit about the stuff you weren't allowed to talk about before, what's new.
I will say that for as far as embargo goes, we cannot talk about the new content. Like,
other like than at what all? Shown.
Nope.
Maybe not even in vague terms, which is probably
fair, but like they don't want, and people don't want to hear. I know a lot of times people like, don't tell me anything, but what did you think kind of thing. But we're not allowed to talk about the new content at all. So like, I just know someone is going to take, so Cullen is reviewing this for us. He's like, did you even play the new content? You didn't even talk about it. It's like, yeah, because we're not allowed to. So
yeah, but I think it's like definitely worth mentioning, at least in the review, saying we can't talk about this.
Yeah, I'm sure he will.
Yeah, the just like, just at least sometimes you just have to tell people outright, we were forbidden to talk about this. I'm sorry.
I'm sure someone will argue that, like, you know, he didn't play it or he's lying or whatever. Like, no.
he didn't review it properly.
They're also finally releasing that new Assassin's Creed game, Shadows game, right? I forgot if that got delayed again or not.
Oh, yeah, that's this that's this next week, too. So.
Yeah. To try to find
who is
someone
covering
to...
that? Did someone cover
Dave.
That?
Dave.
Oh, yeah. Dave is. All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Adam, are you going to get some Assassin's Creed?
No.
You're our biggest Assassin's Creed fan here.
I'm the biggest Assassin's Creed fan. I played, like, 4 of the 12 here. Games or whatever.
That's more. Okay. That's huge. More than us, I think.
Yeah, we'll go with Adam doing it. I'm like thinking of how much I played. I'm like, yes, Adam, it's all you.
Okay. So obviously, check us out online at rpgsite.net. Read the review for Atelier Yumiya. Read the companion pieces for on Steam Deck and comparing the, you know, the Switch and the other console versions. We have the interview with Rise of the Ronin, the developers for the PC release. That's up on the site as well. Follow RPG Site on all the social media channels. Just search for RPG space site, S-I-T-E, and you should be able to find us. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite. If you've listened to this podcast on whatever service you listen to it through or directly on the website, leave us a thumbs up, a rating, or a comment. We'd love to see those. And you'll hear from us next week on the next episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us then, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.